I'm Michael Abrash, obviously, and I'm talking today about Quake and future technologies from id. On behalf of myself and John Carmack, the architect and the driving force behind Quake, and I want to make it very clear that most of the ideas and technology that I'll be talking about are, in fact, John's inventions. I'd also like to thank id for making this talk possible. I don't think there are very many companies that would allow one of their engineers to get up and talk about their current and future technology in front of several thousand people. I think it's pretty public-spirited, especially considering that I don't work at id anymore. And just to answer the frequently asked question, yes, I am back at Microsoft, and I'm working on natural language parsing. Okay, I'm going to start off with a short story here. While I was at id, there was a guy I worked with whose name I won't mention because this could be slightly embarrassing. And one day, he was sitting around eating dinner with a friend, and a couple of friends, actually. And his friend said, well, why don't we go get in my car, drive around that unfinished highway up off the North Tollway? And so they went out, they got onto the highway, they drove around in the dark for a while, having it all to themselves, and eventually they got bored with it, so they started to head back down the exit ramp from that highway onto the tollway. And they're all peering ahead saying, what's that light under the bridge? Is that a cop? And they were peering at it so intently that they didn't notice that there was a concrete barrier in the road. And one of them suddenly screams, stop! And they slam on the brakes, and at 40 miles an hour, they hit the barrier head on. The barrier moves 6 feet, and they stop dead. So the car drives over, and it's a cop. And he gets out, shines his flashlight in, makes sure they're all okay, which they were. And he says, you boys been drinking? And they said, no, officer, we haven't been drinking. He says, you boys been doing drugs? They said, no, honest, officer, we haven't been doing drugs. He says, well, I guess you're just sheer stupid then. besides being amusing, there is a useful lesson in that. And the lesson is that our minds tend to do one thing at a time, and they tend to do it in kind of a familiar way. And the quote from Frederick Pohl's story, The Gold at the Starbow's End, that I start out my proceedings paper with, illustrates that. In it, Pohl is talking about a researcher who ran an experiment which he had a room that had one door in and one door out and a smooth floor in between. And he would take one group of kids, one at a time, and he'd hand them each two boards and two pieces of rope and say, as quickly as you can, get from this door to that door without your feet touching the floor directly. And without fail, they'd look at them, they'd tie the boards on their feet like skis, and they'd shuffle across. Then he took another group, and one at a time he gave them the same instructions, but he handed each of them only one board and one piece of rope. What each of them did was they tied the rope to the end of it, they stood on it like a skateboard, and they kind of swiveled their hips and shuffled across. The interesting thing is that the group with one board got across faster than the group with two boards because they didn't have to take the time to strap them to their feet. So here we have a case where they could have done exactly the same thing that the other group did and gotten across faster, but they instantly snapped the problem to a model they had in their mind. They saw two boards, they said skis, they knew how to solve it. And all of us are like that to some extent or another because we have all these models we work with that we apply to problems that we've used before that work well. And that's obviously necessary, but it can also really be your enemy because change is the rule in this industry. And when I think back and I think how 10 years ago it seemed like the PC was going to be stable forever, and I think about how now my DOS knowledge is useless, my everything up through 486 assembly language is useless, all the graphic stuff I learned before 2 years ago is basically useless, VGAs, you know, all that stuff. It's basically like 2 years is how long your knowledge is good for, which is one product cycle. Writing a 3D net game is really hitting a sweet spot that keeps moving. It's this balance between your performance and your features and the workflow for the artists and level designers and the hardware changing on you and actually shipping. So what you really need to do is you have to be in a position where you sit there and you rethink the problem, you keep trying to snap yourself out of those familiar patterns, and then you figure out what you're going to do, you implement it, and you finish it and ship. And in your mind, ship should be in big capital letters because shipping software is just so difficult. I've seen so many people founder on this one. My friend David Stafford puts it pretty well. He says, shipping software is an unnatural act. a guy I used to work for put it another way. He said, the problem is that after you finish the first 90%, you have to do the other 90%. And although that doesn't speak well for his math skills, I know exactly what he means. The first 90% is when you think the software is perfect. It's building up in your mind. It's still hypothetical. It's going to be the best software anyone's ever seen. And the second 90% is when you're fixing the bugs and you're saying, I'm not going to fix all the bugs. And you see the new features you could do because you know more and the hardware's changed. And there is no such thing as perfect software. All there is an appropriate thing in an appropriate time. So last year I talked about Quake, but at least half of you weren't here because that room only seated half as many people. And it wasn't finished at the time, quite a bit changed. And John and I understand more about the characteristics of Quake now. Can you flip the slide? So this time, I'm going to start out with a high bandwidth core dump of how Quake ended up and how Quake works. And then I'll talk for the other half of the time about how Quake is currently evolving, because it's continuing to change in a lot of ways. Quake World, GLQuake, VQuake, going on to Quake 2. And I'll talk a bit about where its technology is heading in the future. So the first half is going to be familiar to those of you who were here last year. But there will be some new stuff. And in fact, there's a ton of stuff in this. When I practiced it on my own, it took an hour and 15 minutes, even though I talked really fast. So I'm going to talk even faster. It's going to be very highly technical. And there's just actually an insane amount of information. But they left this room available until 5 o'clock. And if people have questions, I'll stick around. I'll explain things I didn't explain well or things that I forgot or whatever. But I'm going to try to get you out of here by 1:30 for the next round of talk. And this stuff's in the proceedings. A lot of it is. Before I begin with Quake, I want to answer a question I've heard a lot of times in a lot of ways over the past few months. And that is, with 3D accelerators, is the programming thrill gone from doing 3D games? And I understand what the question means, because writing a perspective correct rasterizer is just, it's a fun kind of challenge. But the truth is that the challenge has moved on to be larger and more complex than just a good rasterizer. 3D hardware and the internet have enabled some really hard open-ended problems now. Things like, how do you do level of detail for a big open world? How do you do visibility occlusion? How do you see onto other servers? How do you handle networking together with limited bandwidth, really rich worlds? And then there are the parts that everybody basically sort of lets slide. They don't push very hard at all, like physics and AI, that I think are going to become significantly more important. And then there's tools. Everything is tending towards these bigger, more complex, rich, tied together worlds. And the tools to build those are pretty tough to come up with. And in fact, more than half of id's source base is tools, not Quake itself. So as I go, notice how little of this talk is about software rasterization. In Quake, it was a lot of code. It was a tough challenge. We spent a lot of time optimizing it. And frankly, it would be really nice in the future to be able to spend that huge chunk of time working on other types of problems. Okay, in Quake, there are two types of things. There's the world, which is static, always. You can think of it as the walkthrough background for everything. And there are entities, which is everything that moves. And they have very different rendering. So I'm going to talk about those two things separately, starting with the world. Can you flip the slide? There's no way to talk about the world without talking about pre-processing first, because the world is very heavily pre-processed. It's built from brushes, which are convex polyhedra. Everything in Quake started out as a convex polyhedron. So there's no such thing as an infinitely thin wall, for example. There are only things that have solid insides and empty outsides, those. And the first step in processing is to take those polyhedra and fuse them together into one. Basically, they're broken down and then they're healed back together into one big continuous skin and mesh for the whole world. Then that's used to build a BSP tree. Now, once I gave a talk on BSPs, and after an hour I realized you can't get up and give a talk about BSPs and explain them. They're just not that kind of data structure. People have to work with them and visualize them themselves. So I'm not going to explain how a BSP tree is built or how it works. I'm going to talk about what it does for the game, and then you can go read about BSPs. The first obvious thing a BSP tree does is it gives you draw order. It lets you go front to back through the world or back to front. So you can do the painter's algorithm and draw back to front, and you get that just by walking the tree. And for hardware, you can do the same thing, as I'll discuss. It can help. It's not as critical. In software, it's really important. BSP trees do other things, though, that aren't directly rendering oriented that are also really important. One thing it does is it gives you line of sight. All you need to do to determine if you can see something in Quake is you take the point you're at and the thing you're trying to see, you take the line segment between them, you clip it into the BSP tree. When you reach the leaves, you say, are any of these leaves solid? If a leaf is solid, you can't see it. If the leaf isn't solid, you can see it, if all leaves aren't solid. And that's really all. And that's so much better than other line of sight approaches. It's amazing, very fast. Another thing a BSP tree does is it gives you convex partitioning of the world. And when we get to the PVS, you'll see how important that can be. Convex partitionings, what I've heard from people who are very good researchers and developers is they say that none of them like BSP trees, but none of them can come up with really good convex partitionings any other way. And what a BSP tree does is it generates one automatically without fail. So as I talk, whenever I use the word leaf, remember that a leaf is a convex polyhedron and that you had to get it from somewhere. And a BSP tree is a good way to do that. The other thing a BSP tree does is it's a hierarchical structure. Your first subspace is the whole world, and then it gets split in half by the first splitter, and that gets split in half again. So what you get is you get a hierarchical set of subspaces, each one nested in the previous one. And you similarly get a hierarchical set of bounding boxes, and that lets you apply for clipping, for example, properties of a whole box to all its children. So as we go through here, you'll see that also. The two things I'll say about BSPs is that a BSP consists of two fundamental structures, nodes and leaves. Nodes are splitters. The splitters are on the planes of the polygon. So we take the whole world, we find a polygon, we take its plane, we split the world into half along its plane. Then we take another polygon and we do the same thing again. Those are the nodes. The leaves are the subspaces that all the nodes carve the world into. The reason I'm bringing this up is because the easy way to do polygons in a BSP tree is to clip all the polygons all the way down into the leaves. And then just when you come to a leaf, as you walk the tree, you just draw all the polygons in the leaf. Because it's a convex polyhedron, and all the polygons are on the face of the polyhedron, they can't occlude each other. So you just walk the tree in order, say back to front. Every time you come to a leaf, draw everything front facing in it. And that's it. You're done. That's really simple. The problem is that then you have to clip all the polygons all the way into the leaves. You end up with a lot more polygons. It gives you more transforms, more projections, and more rendering setup overhead. So what we did instead was we put the polygons on the nodes. And it's a little bit complicated to explain how this works. I'm just going to briefly run over it, and you can always go back and read through the proceedings. When we render, we say we walk in front of a node, and the polygons are on the node itself. And when we're done walking in front of the node, we will have reached all the leaves that can be visible. When we reach those leaves, we mark the polygons that are in the leaf. And when we get back to the node, we say, were any of the polygons on this node marked as visible? If they are, I'll draw them. Now, I'm going to go over this again when I get to rendering, so it makes more sense. But it's an important point because if you put the polygons on the nodes, they don't get clipped by any of their children nodes or leaves. And they get much bigger. And in Quake, when we made this change, it got 10% faster. So although it's a little bit complicated, it's something well worth doing. You should always put the polygons on the nodes if you can. One final note is building a BSP tree is an extremely difficult problem. You can't build an optimal one basically in less than the heat death of the universe, because it's an n factorial problem, and we're talking about 10,000 polygons. So, in fact, the first BSP tree I ever built was 21 factorial, with only 21 polygons, and that turned out to be pretty close to heat death of the universe. So you have to pick a heuristic, and it does make a big difference what heuristic you pick. Originally, John was using a heuristic of trying to split into approximately equal areas, volumes, because he thought that would give a more level performance. When he switched to instead picking as a splitter the polygon that split the fewest of the other polygons in its subspace, it made a big difference. It reduced the count by double-digit percents. So we use that fewest splitter heuristic, and we only get about 15% more polygons coming out of the BSP process than we had going in. Okay, can you flip? After the BSP is built, we can then remove all exterior polygons. Now, think of it this way. You build a Quake level out of these convex polyhedra, but logically, a Quake level is enclosed. You can think of it as being carved out of a block of stone with just infinite solid around it. So what we do is we leak test the inside by flood filling, and if the inside isn't solid, the level designer has to fix it. If it is, we flood fill it, and then we strip away all the polygons on the outsides of walls where you're never supposed to be able to go. And it turns out that's a big chunk of the polygons in a level. And removing them not only reduces the size of the data set that we have to load into memory, but it also dramatically reduces the cost of later pre-processing steps like lighting and PVS calculations. Okay. Now, in order to handle a Quake size level, to say nothing of stuff coming in the future, you need large-scale culling. A Quake level has 10,000 polygons in it. And there's just no way software is going to draw 10,000 large polygons adequately quickly, especially when only 400 or 500 are typically visible. And I'll show you how much difference a large-scale culling approach can make. See if you can tell when we get to the point where the culling kicks in. Okay? It is a good thing. What we use for large-scale culling is what's called the potentially visible set. And the definition of the potentially visible set is all the polygons in all the leaves that you could conceivably see from anywhere in the leaf you're in. So you're in a space, not too huge, but a convex subspace. If you were in that corner, if you were in that corner, if you were anywhere in it, what are the things you could manage to see? Now, that's not the same as everything you can see. You're standing in one place, and a lot of that may be occluded. But it still reduces the polygons you have to consider by more than 90%. So obviously one advantage is that it limits the amount of stuff you have to draw at runtime. Now, I'll point out that it needs an amenable data set. I mean, this room isn't going to help much with PVS because everything is inside this room. If you're inside an asteroid, you know, a hollowed-out asteroid, that wouldn't help. So in Quake, you'll notice an awful lot of levels get exited by right-angle turns. And the reason is you can't see around a right-angle turn. It's not a solution to all problems. It's a solution to a specific type of level. Another advantage of the PVS, though, is that it limits the order of some of the pre-processing steps, in particular lighting. Because you come to a place where normally you'd say, wow, I've got an n-squared problem. I have to consider every other polygon from this light. But you don't. You only have to consider the things in the PVS from the light. And it reduces the order of it greatly, particularly because the actual PVS size doesn't go up significantly with level size. So it basically turns it into a problem that doesn't go up a whole lot, maybe linearly at worst. Now, that doesn't mean that it makes it fast. It means it makes it less horribly slow. Last year, I talked about how we had a four-processor alpha, and I'm sure all of you said, wow, like we can afford four-processor alphas. But we had a four-processor alpha, and it still took 20 or 30 minutes to do the BSPing and the lighting and everything. Well, now we have an eight-processor SGI. The bad news is Quake 2 levels are bigger. So now it takes 40 minutes to do the worst levels. But the good news is that a Pentium Pro, a quad Pentium Pro that you can buy for about $10,000, has the same performance as the alpha we used to do Quake. And that was not $10,000, believe me. And also, it's worth pointing out that you don't have to completely BSP and do the viz and everything on a level every time. You don't have to go through all the steps. You can do approximate stuff that has some dropouts that are good enough for the level developers to work with. Nonetheless, John and I were talking about this, and he thinks we probably push things too far in the direction of pre-processing this time. You almost never see that, where you just, the pre-processing is the blocking factor, but it did interfere with the workflow. And probably doing it again, we would take away a little runtime performance in exchange for less pre-processing. You say, wow, that PVS sure sounds big. The truth is that the PVS from any given leaf is only a few hundred polygons. So we store it as a bit array. Each bit is an index into the whole leaf array. And it run length encodes terrifically because 95% of the bits are zero. So it ends up being 20 to 50K for the whole level, which is not a significant amount. OK. I'm going to address a question that I've gotten in email a lot of times. And I keep saying, well, I can't explain this in email. So I'm going to try to explain it by actually drawing it out. It's how the potentially visible set gets built. And I will say it's not a trivial problem. It took John several months to solve this on and off. But initially, he was trying sampling approaches. And the sampling approaches, well, they worked most of the time. And occasionally, you know, you'd get in just the right place, and something would vanish, and you'd just have a gap. And it really requires an analytic solution. And what the solution basically is it's clipping through portals. Portals are the open faces of leaves where there isn't a polygon. So if you have a room that has walls on all sides except one, and that side's open into another space, that's a portal. You can see through it. And what it consists of is you say, OK, I'm in a leaf. I can see into the next leaf, obviously, because I see right through this portal. Now, what can I see through the portal out to the other leaf? And it's a clipping problem. You say, you take the clipping planes that delimit the maximum amount you could see, and you keep clipping them against farther and farther portals until they go away. And I'm going to take a shot at drawing this in 2D. I hope this cable fits, reaches. Can you flip it? Ah, I made it. OK, so let's say that this is the leaf we're standing in. So we're right here. But we could be anywhere in the leaf as far as the PVS is concerned. So if we were here, if we were here, if we were here, it just wants to know about anything that's possible. So here's a portal. We say, obviously, we can see through this portal. So this is in the PVS. Then we say, OK, what portals does this have? In this case, there's only one. So we say, OK, what can we see from our leaf through this portal, through that portal? Well, that's pretty easy. You draw this through here, and you draw this through here. And you say, I can see everything between them through this portal. So this in here is visible. And by God, this is in it too. So now we know that this leaf is also part of our potentially visible set. Then we say, OK, what can we see through that portal, and through that portal? Well, from this portal, we can see that and that. But that space is completely excluded from this space. Therefore, we can't see any of this. Therefore, this is not in the potentially visible set. We don't go through that portal. That's the end of it. And that's really all there is to it. Now, the implementation is a little tougher, but it's just a clipping problem. But I will point out, it took months to come to the insight that it was a clipping problem. Okay, can you flip back to the previous slide? Okay, now, one interesting thing is that in 2D, the way I just drew it for you, it gives you the right results for the PVS. In 3D, it gives you sloppy results, and the reason is that you're doing portal to portal, where a portal is a polygon in 3D, visibility, and if you look at the surfaces between two arbitrary polygons connecting them, they're quadratic surfaces, they're not linear planes. And for performance reasons, it makes no sense to try to use quadratic surfaces, so we use planes and the PVS is bigger than it really should be. Also, it's sloppy because it's leaf to leaf. It's, you know, it pretends you're standing anywhere in a leaf, and there will be a case where you're standing somewhere, and there's a wall over here, and you can't see any of that stuff, but your leaf goes past that wall. So all that stuff has to be considered. And some thought has been given to an exactly visible set, and John thinks it's technically possible. He thinks he knows how it would work, but it requires, as an intermediate data structure, a six-dimensional space with hyperbolic separating planes, and he doesn't actually know how to make that work currently. I'm sure it can be done. I'm not sure about the runtime performance of it or anything. But it's an interesting problem, simply because sometimes we get twice as many polygons as we really should. It would be nice to have an exactly visible set. Okay, there's also the potentially hearable set. And Chris Hacker will tell you, why isn't the potentially audible set? And it's because John called it the potentially hearable set, and he thought it up, so it's his name. The PHS is a one-bounce PVS. So it's all the leaves you can see from the leaf you're in, plus all the leaves that leaf can see. So it can see around corners, but obviously it doesn't go infinitely far. And what it is it turns out to be a really useful approximation of the relevant non-line-of-sight event space. What I mean by that is sound. Right now, in Quake, all the sounds in the world get sent to you by the server because the server doesn't know what you can hear. And you hear sounds through walls. You can be standing on one side of a wall and there's a battle over there. It would take you a minute to get around to it. You still hear it because we don't have any information about that for things that aren't direct line of sight. So what Quake 2 will have is it'll have, not only will you not hear through walls because it'll use the potentially hearable set, but it'll mute things that are one bounce away. They're not in the PVS, but they're in the PHS. The really big win from this, though, was modem bandwidth, to know what sounds had to be sent and what sounds didn't have to be sent. And when John put this, the PHS, into Quake World, the level designers took three of the bases, the first three bases from the first three episodes, glued them all together into mega base, and it is huge. It's weird wandering around it because you just keep going. And 32 people played over modems, and it actually worked because the sounds were filtered down to the set that really mattered. The PHS is also useful for handling events that have their centers outside the PVS, but extend into it. A good example is lighting. Right now, if there's an explosion on the other side of a wall, it lights up through the wall. If there's an explosion around a corner, it has to poke out into your visible space so you see the pieces, even though the center wasn't in the PVS. So turns out to be a generally useful thing for restricting in ever larger levels the number of things you actually have to consider. Okay, now we come to light maps. I'll explain how these are used later, but what light maps are, they're 16 texel grids, grid samplings of all the static lighting in the world. So when the level is built, for every light in the world, for every polygon it lands on 16 texel grid points, there's a sample done of what the level is. And this process is pretty expensive. There are a lot of lights in a level. You don't realize how many because they're not real lights. They don't behave like real lights and bounce light. So the artists have to stick a whole lot of extra ones in there. This process, in terms of the time it takes, is helped enormously by the PVS and the BSP. The PVS is useful because for each light, you only have to look at the surfaces that are in its own PVS instead of rejecting everything in the world. And the BSP is really useful because if you want to try to land a light on each of these grid points, all you do is you clip a line into the world between the two points and see if it hits anything solid. And I'll just point out that even though the light maps are spaced pretty far apart, 16 texels is actually a lot, but you can see in places like right up, well, I can't point to it, but if you look at the screen, you'll see that there's actually some pretty subtle shading effects where the light gets cast. You don't realize that it's such a coarse sampling, partly because the results are filtered. So it would be nice to have more detailed lighting even than this, but it does tend to look smooth and it does tend to produce realistic effects. One final thing, this was a nice little detail, is that in Quake, we used a directory subdirectory structure for all the Quake data. The maps and the models and the sprites and everything were in a certain directory structure off of the id1 directory. But we made it so that Quake was capable of taking an additional path ahead of that, which meant you could basically subclass an experiment very easily. So as we were developing, we each could set it up so that the stuff we were messing with was searched for first without having to copy the whole directory or worry about bringing things back into the main tree. And it turned out not only to be useful for development, but for add-ons. Things like Capture the Flag have been implemented this way, where people just subclass Quake to make it do different things. And it was a nice little development detail. OK, flip the slide. Yikes. I may have to talk even faster. OK, now we finally come. That was all pre-processing. We haven't actually done anything except build the data yet. Now we come to drawing the world. The first thing we do when we draw the world is we mark the PVS for the current viewpoint. So what we do is we go and we decompress the bit array for the current leaf's PVS. And then for each of the 1 bits, we go out, we find that leaf, we mark it, we store the current frame in it, and we bubble that up the tree until we come to the top of the tree or to the node, a node that already says, I'm marked in the PVS. And the reason we bubble it up is because we also need to know if nodes are in the PVS for when we walk the BSP tree, as we'll see shortly. The reason we use the current frame is otherwise we'd have to clear the result from the previous frame. This way we just say, oh, is it the current frame? And I mean, once every 2 to the 32nd it rolls over, but there's no damage done. Once we've marked the PVS, we walk the BSP front to back, not back to front. We walk in front of the node, then we process the node, then we walk behind the node. As we come to each node, what we do is we say, is the node's bounding volume, its bounding box, is this node in the PVF? If it's not, we don't even look at it. We say, is the node's bounding volume in the view pyramid? If it's not, we don't look at it. And the thing is, that's where the hierarchical structure comes in, because everything in that node, all the nodes under it, all the leaves, just gets thrown away with one test for both the PVS and for the clipping. If it turns out it's partially clipped or not clipped at all, we can also reuse that information. Say we come to a node and we say, wow, this node is totally unclipped. Then all the nodes below it and all its children don't need to be tested for anything. It saves a tremendous amount of clipping. So we walk forward from a node. When we finally reach a leaf, we say, gee, what polygons touch this leaf? Each of those is marked with the current frame number. So a polygon can be marked multiple times because it can touch multiple leaves. Then when we get back up to the node, after having walked all the leaves in front of it, we say, OK, are any of the polygons on this node marked as visible? If they are, we clip them, we transform them, we project them. If they came through the clipping and got transformed and projected, we add them to the edge list. We do this for all the polygons in the world. Now, the edge list is an intermediate rasterization structure and something, I don't know if I'd say of a hack, but it's not one of the more elegant data structures. It's similar to the kind of global edge table that you use for rasterizing concave polygons. All the edges that are actually potentially drawable, in other words, they were in the potentially visible set and they survived clipping, all of them get put into one big edgeless structure in screen coordinates. We're down to rasterization now. We finally made it. This is rasterization. And that whole list gets scanned out at once. And what you get when you're done is you get a set of spans that covers the screen exactly once. It's all the nearest spans in the entire world. And the sorting is done by BSP order, which is really convenient because BSP order is infallible, unlike sorting on calculated Z or whatever. So we calculate this set of spans that cover the screen once and exactly once for all the nearest polygons. And those spans are hung off their relevant surfaces, which you can think of as being their polygons. So we get no overdraw coverage. And this is a big thing. Our software rasterizer is fast for what it does, but it's not that fast. You'll understand why a little when I get to explaining how the lighting works. So it's really critical that we not end up with 2 or 3 times overdraw sometimes. When we did have that, performance was not very level. You'd spin around and you could see it go jerk, jerk, jerk. So once we have all these spans constructed, we go through each surface, we say, any spans on you? And if there are, what we do is we pass those to the rasterizer. And the reason that we draw surface by surface is for setup coherency and also, as you'll see, because we have to construct the textures we draw from, and we don't want to construct it more than once. So the objective here with the edge list was to get level performance. It doesn't probably help average performance very much, and certainly it hurts worst case performance because you have to go through this whole intermediate data structure where if you were just doing polygons and there was no overdraw, it would be faster. But it's no good going 30 frames a second on average and running 2 frames a second in your worst case, and this did help level performance a lot. I will say this technology has a window of usefulness, and Quake is the end of it. You know, when I talk about the sweet spot, this doesn't scale. 500 polygons, sure. 5,000 polygons, no way, because we tried it. We tried putting all the complex moving polygon models in it, and you know what? It fell over dead. It just isn't built to deal with that much data. So we got extra complexity, and it needs a PVS, because it can't handle this stuff by itself. It can't handle that many polygons. That's why I called it not very elegant. And we came away with the feeling that there was probably something better that we could have come up with, but we didn't have time, and this did do the job. So now we're really into rasterization, which is texture mapping the spans, and there's not really that much to it. It's perspective correct approximately. And the way that works is that we take a span, we're going to draw it, and we calculate 1 over z and s and t over z, the texture coordinates, every 16 pixels across the span. And that is exactly perspective correct. In between those 16 pixel points, we do linear interpolation. And in fact, while the linear interpolation is going on, we do an fdiv to calculate 1 over z. Now, fdiv normally is 42 cycles, but we set the precision down to single, so it's 19 cycles, and then we overlap it with the integer stuff, so it's actually one cycle effectively. So we do this linear integer in between, and that is not exactly right. I mean, there are places where with high frequency textures you can see that it's not quite perspective correct, but it's certainly not a major issue, and you can see that if I walk up to a wall and look at it at a sharp angle, things do not do horrible warping. You know, they still look pretty much right. And it is possible to set the subdivision to 8 instead of 16, which is certainly more accurate, and watch how little the pixels move from this. Okay, see, there's a tiny, Oh, is it too dim?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That better? More? How about that? Well, I'm going to go even farther. How about that? Okay, so let's see where I left. Okay, so here it is with 16 pixel subdivision, and here it is with 8. Okay, most of you probably couldn't even see anything move. And that's because it doesn't move very far. This turned out to have been a good trade-off between performance and high quality. And one point is that there's a lot of floating point. I mean, those 1 over z calculations are still in floating point. We take it far down the pipeline. And I will say that using floating point made life so much easier, made the code cleaner or solider. It's sort of like hardware 3D rasterization, and then it freed us to concentrate on other things than like trying to scale our fixed point numbers and keep them from overflowing and clamping and stuff. And I strongly recommend floating point for the future. And in fact, on the Pentium Pro, there's a lot of hand-tuned Pentium assembly for floating point in here. But on the Pentium Pro, it's not an issue because the processor just rearranges it for you anyway, and it's really good for floating point. there are two other rasterizers I'll just briefly mention. The lava water things that kind of sit there and go blum, blum, blum. Those are procedural texture mappers that just do a dual sinusoidal warp simultaneously from a tiling texture. So all that does is it picks them up in sinusoidal patterns and slaps them down. The sky textures are a spherical projection, and the reason that they parallax is we just rebuild the tile with the parallaxing each time. There's nothing real sophisticated to those. The last bit of rasterization there is that after we've drawn all these spans, we go through again and we draw exactly the same spans to fill in the z-buffer. It's a fill pass. We don't do z-buffering to draw the world, but we need z-buffering later, as I'll discuss. So we just take exactly the same spans, which have all the data, and we jam in all the z-values. And it's really handy here having no overdraw. Okay, can you flip the slide? Now we come to lighting, which is one of the more unusual parts of the Quake architecture. The typical way to do 3D lighting is with either it's with distance lighting, like in Doom, which we definitely didn't want to do, or Gouraud shading. And Gouraud shading does linear interpolation of lights from vertices. There are some serious quality problems with that. One is that if you have more than 3 vertices and you turn, it's not rotationally invariant. You see stuff shift. It's not perspective correct, which I used to think didn't matter. It turns out to be quite visible sometimes. And you can't get detailed lighting without a lot of polygons, because basically where you choose to put your geometry determines what kind of lighting quality you can get. So what John came up with instead is surface-based lighting. In surface-based lighting, the texture is tiled into a memory buffer, and at the same time, that light map I talked about is used to light it, and with bilinear filtering between the grid points for the light. So basically, you can think of it as you've got this tile for the texture, and you've got this light map across the whole thing, and you're stamping in the tiles, and you're lighting them according to the light map at the same time. for the polygon you're about to draw. Then after you've built it, that becomes your texture map to actually do the rasterization from, with no lighting in the actual code inner loop. Now clearly, doing that, building to memory buffer and then drawing from it, is going to be slower than just doing Garot shading. So we added caching. We keep surfaces around in basically just a circular roving heap. One thing that made it possible to do that, both in terms of size and in terms of speed, was the fact that we do MIP mapping. Beyond a certain distance, we take the texture and we filter it down at a 4-to-1 ratio. Beyond another distance, we do the same thing. So that most of the polygons in a scene actually aren't shown at their full texel density. And that's actually a good thing, not a bad thing, because it gets rid of a lot of aliasing artifacts. But MIP mapping is critical to doing any kind of surface caching approach, because otherwise it would just be a huge data set. So with the caching, performance isn't quite as level as you might expect, because occasionally you'll turn sharply or you'll come around a corner and there just have to be a lot of surfaces built. And sometimes it's slower. It's probably pretty roughly comparable. But it's much better looking than Garot given the same size polygons. And if you had Garot with enough detail of polygons to get these same kind of effects, it's unclear that it would be as fast. One of the huge advantages of surfaces is that, which we didn't even use, is that it allows you to do post-processing. If you want to put splatters on the wall, if you want to put pock marks there, if you want to have drips, stick them in. They'll be cached along with everything else. And when you draw, they'll be perfectly perspective texture mapped for free. OK. Now we come to the one other kind of lighting, which is dynamic lighting. Now, at the last CGDC, we didn't have dynamic lighting. There were no muzzle flashes. There were no explosions lighting up the world. The world stayed lit exactly the same way. And John was pretty much convinced that that was eye candy and it wasn't a fundamental difference. And Billy Zelznick, who's another 3D engine guy, showed us a demo of his technology. And the demo was far from finished, but one thing he did was he shot a flare out into the world. And as that flare went past the walls, John and I looked at each other and said, maybe we need to do this. So we got back and we decided, yeah, it would be important to do it. And I immediately sat down and spent several days making the surface building as fast as I could, down to nearly two cycles a texel being built, which turned out I should have done that anyway, because it meant that when you went around corners or when you spun, it was no longer a problem. So I did that. And then it kind of got backburnered because we had so many other things to do. And one Saturday, John turned to me and said, well, why don't you go ahead and put in that dynamic lighting? And I said, well, I have something else to do, and I want to get it done first, so I'll do it tomorrow. And then a little while later, he turned to me and said, you know, I bet I can do that in 1 hour. So I said, OK, that would be good. 1 hour is good. So John sat there, and we actually tried to distract him, but you can't distract John. And 1 hour and 9 minutes later, he had dynamic lighting in. So it wasn't 1 hour, but it was close. And part of getting it in 1 hour is that it's stunningly inaccurate. I mean, I'm going to try to find a good place here where I can show you a dynamic light in slow motion. I hope I remember to do no target mode. We'll find out. Whoops. OK. Watch where the circles are on the walls as I shoot this. Oops. Well, that was the dog. And now you've seen particles. OK, watch where the circles are. Oops, I have to aim up a little bit more. Here, I'll slow it down. R, which is it, host, frame rate, 0.0. OK, here we go. Well, I slowed it down, right? OK. Did those look geometrically correct to you? They're linear projections of a very specific type of circle. There's no correct falloff. There's no correct accounting for angle. There's nothing. And sometimes you'll just see like a dot on a wall, and you say, how could there be a dot on a wall? But you know, it's also enormously effective. I mean, I slowed it down here, so you could tell how inaccurate it was. But it still doesn't really matter. The feedback was so much more important. And one thing about this is that, brilliant as John is, seeing something happen just has an effect on your brain. Suddenly you say, oh, now I understand. And it's really just something I would encourage you to do quick and dirty hacks to see things, just to try them, to see what they're like. Because so often, it's you see it, and then you say, I got to have that. And that's one thing that 3D hardware makes more possible. One thing I want to point out is that apart from dynamic lighting, which is grossly inaccurate, The lighting approach we use for the world, plus the subpixel and subtextual correct texture mapping and the exactly correct hidden surface removal, always because of the BSP order, means that the world is visually very solid and stable. There are other things that I'll talk about later that are not at this level, but we really did want to get a world that felt solid. And actually, I'm glad to see 3D hardware coming along, because I think people will have more games like this. It always pains me to see a game ship with shifting, cracking textures and polygons when they could just go read Chris Hecker's articles in Game Developer and, you know, learn how to do it, because it's doable now. Okay, now we come to entities. Entities are anything that move, because without them, what you get is a walkthrough. And entities are not as elegant as this model. Every one of them in their own way is basically a hack. We wanted one renderer. We really wanted one renderer. We tried it. We tried putting things through the same model, and it just wasn't going to be fast enough. It wasn't going to give us the flexibility. One point about entities is that they get called to the bounding box relative to the PVS and relative to the view pyramid. So that helps tremendously with the net and graphics processing. Some of them are pretty expensive to draw, and there are a lot of them in the world. There are hundreds of entities in the world, and for that stuff not to have to come over the net and have to be rejected explicitly every time by rendering is a big win. There are four kinds of entities, BSP models, polygon models, sprites, and particles. I'll go through each one separately. Okay, can you flip the slide? BSP models are things like doors, ammo boxes, there we go. Okay, so that's a BSP model right there. It's a BSP model that won't open because I haven't gotten there yet, so I'm going to noclip through it. Okay, that's a BSP model. That's actually fairly complex for one, because they tend to be simple angular objects. So there you go. BSP models, to the greatest extent possible, are treated just like world polygons. They go through the edge list. They occlude things. There's no overdraw with them. The hard part with BSP models is that because they move, you can't say, oh, here's your BSP node order. You don't have one, because as you move it, it falls in different places in the BSP tree, the world BSP. So what we have to do is figure out how to get them to sort properly in the edge list while doing as little different work as possible. So we take a BSP model, every frame we need to draw it, and we clip it into the world BSP so that every fragment of every polygon in it is in exactly one leaf. Then we insert those into the edge list, and their sort order relative to the world is the leaf that they got clipped into. Leaves fall between nodes, so that gives you a good clean sort order. The problem is, what if you have two of these in the same leaf? How do you sort them? How do you know who's in front? So what we do there in the edge list, if we come to two of these and have to sort them against each other, we do floating point operations to calculate their 1 over z distance from you, and that's what we use for the ordering. Now, 1 over z sorting turns out to be pretty tricky. We tried putting it in Quake around the time of the last CGDC, thinking we could get bigger polygons just like we did out of putting them on nodes. And what we found is it's kind of a fragile approach, because as you walk an edge, you get these little fixed point inaccuracies, and then when you calculate the 1 over z, you get these little floating point inaccuracies. And it just turns out that occasionally you get things that butt up against each other and they snap past each other. So for a world, it turned out to be not a really great thing, but here it's limited enough usage that it works fine. But it's also an illustration of one of the beauties of BSP order, which is that it just works. You don't have to worry about it. It's one integer compare, and it works. So there's still no overdraw because these get put in the edge list. So as we walk up to this, so this door, we're not drawing twice as much stuff as we otherwise would because that door is there. But it can't affect the PVS because it's not always there to cut off the PVS. So if we do this to draw the PVS back to front, what you'll see is we see right through it. So see how big the PVS is from here. So doors are kind of halfway in between. They still give you zero overdraw, but they force you to still consider large PVSs, which is unfortunate because what would be nice if you could use a door instead of a twisting tunnel to block off part of the view. So BSP models are useful, but they're really useful for relatively simple boxy stuff that doesn't have a ton of polygons to have to clip in and then put into the edge list. For the really complicated, not simple boxy stuff, we use polygon models, which are triangle meshes with front and back skins. Can you flip, please? These have far more geometric complexity. They, uh, Some of them in Quake have more than 500 polygons, and that's going up in Quake 2. In fact, there are more polygons in one Hell Knight than there are in an entire scene that you'll see in Quake, almost ever. There are also lots of frames. The zombies, for example, have well over 100 frames, so there are high memory demands for these. And that combination forced us to be much less precise with these than we were with the world. They're affine texture mapping, not perspective, because they're small and distant and usually can't notice except the view model. The weapon in front of you is also affine, and it took the artist a long time to get that to come out right. They're gross shaded, and the funny thing with the gross shading, okay, they have directional light on them, but if you look carefully, it's always from the same direction. It has nothing to do with any lights in the world. It's like you're always lit from the north. And it sounds like, well, what's the point of that? But what it does is, because there is a lighting gradient, it lets the gross shading do its stuff and make it look less boxy. It would have been better to put in directional lights, and I hope that gets into Quake 2, but it's turned out to be not as key. Another thing that we do is, in software, we snap the vertices to integer coordinates so that we can have a simpler integer rasterizer. And so what that means is something, if you move very slightly, you'll see things rippling and popping on the screen. Another reason you see that is that different frames, every frame is compressed, every coordinate in every frame is compressed to one byte. There are only 256 possible x, 256 possible y, 256 possible z coordinates. We need to do that to get the frames under 1k a pop. And so what that means is that if you can find someone who's just kind of standing there, and you're in no target mode, and you walk up to them and you say, wow, I wonder how smooth he looks. Here, let's find somebody who's not going anywhere. I'm sure there's someone here. Hey, they're all walking. Behind me? Well, he's walking, and the dead guy's not moving at all. Oh, okay, great. I'm glad you know better than I do. Which way?
Through the door.
Oh, right here. Okay. Okay, now, notice that he is not moving fluidly, right? You can see him snapping between the different frames because we don't have enough coordinates. And similarly, if I move very, well, I can't move, well, maybe with the mouse I can. If I move slightly, oh, ow. Anyway, you can definitely see that is not smooth movement. It's a popping motion. And that's because we just, it was the only way to get it in there at all. Now, that, in Quake 2, it's going to be smoother, there'll be more polygons, but this was just, the miracle was getting these guys working fast enough. And we were working on that right up till the end. And in fact, one reason was, one of the big problems was occlusion, because we wanted to put him in the edge list, we tried it, it would mean that there would be 5,000 instead of 500 edges, and it just got way too slow. So then we tried thinking about, well, can we clip them into the BSP, but then how do we sort them against each other? We'll clip them against each other. It was just not going to work. So we had, our approach was to have a rough BSP sort where we would sort the vertices into the BSP and kind of approximately say, here's the right drawing order, and then we'd bucket sort within each model to try to get the model right. And, you know, it worked most of the time, but sometimes a model would turn and all of a sudden his ribs would come out through his arm, literally. Or sometimes someone would be coming around a corner and all of a sudden his whole body would be in front of the corner. I mean, and if you had two of them standing next to each other, it was random what would happen. So finally, it really bothered John. I mean, it ran fast enough, but it really bothered him that the world was looked so much better. And he figured that we should do Z-buffering. And it cost us 10% to do the Z-fill for the world. Then it cost us a little in the drawing loops for the polygon models. But, you know, they're really small and far away almost all the time. So that turns out not to be a big problem. And the PVS rejects most of the models. If we had to do all 100 models on a level, put them through a Z-buffer, that would be hopeless. But we don't. And the truth is, it just works really nicely. We're very happy with the Z-buffering. And some people have literally said that it has been seduced by the Z-buffer because it's so low-tech. And the truth is, it made the code enormously simpler. It always works. It fits the hardware model. And it enables you to post-process, as we'll see with particles shortly. What Z-buffering means is if you can figure out how to draw an effect, you can insert it in the world, which is a very powerful statement. One last thing about the polygon models is that when you get a polygon model that, say, has, oh, 300 polygons, and you get far away from it, not even that far away, you know, oops, it's kind of a blob of pixels. Let's go out where they're farther away, though, because most of them are really quite a distance. Okay. So look up there. I mean, you see that guy walking? He's your basic blob. I mean, see, it's not exactly a blob. We couldn't just draw a bunch of green pixels, but you sure aren't seeing much detail. And I'm running this at 640 by 480. Okay, now he's really a blob of pixels, right? I mean, there are maybe 30 or 40 pixels in him, and there are 300 polygons. So it seems crazy that we go through all the work of rasterizing every one of those polygons, most of which have 0 pixels, and some of which have maybe 1 pixel. So again, there were a lot of approaches proposed for trying to blobize these things. And what John finally came up with was what we call a subdivision rasterizer, in which we draw all the vertices in the model, and then we look at each triangle and we say, is there a side in this triangle that's longer than one? If it is, let's split it in half by shifting, just by shifting, all the texture coordinates, everything. We're not going to worry about how exact we are. We'll split it in half, we'll draw that point, we now have 2 more triangles we can apply this to recursively. And, you know, it's really inaccurate. It follows no known fill rules relative to anything else. The texturing, I mean, you know, you're dividing it by 2. Sometimes that's right. If you get big triangles, it's really slow. I mean, you get up really close with one of those and everything slows to a crawl. But it's perfect for this. I mean, see if you can detect where this switches over as I walk up to this guy. Okay? There he is. I'm walking up. Okay? At some point there, he changed. You don't even really have any idea where that point is, because obviously we picked a changeover to be a point where it didn't matter. But the truth is, it's only about 30 feet away. So I think that this is just a great example of what I was talking about at the beginning, not getting locked into a familiar approach, saying, I know how to rasterize triangles, therefore what I should do is I should make the triangle rasterization as fast as I can. You might say, well, how else can I get the same effect? Flip the slide. Now we come to sprites. And basically, from our perspective, sprites have become kind of evil. We didn't want to have any. And after CGDC, we converted over, for example, the torches became polygon models, which isn't perfect. You walk up to them and you say, you know, what is this? It looks like a popcorn machine or something. But it still looks a lot better. You should have seen it when they were sprites. It looks better than the sprites because the sprites kind of tilt. They do funny things. They're clearly wrong. But we didn't convert a few things, because as of CGDC last year, the explosions were just particle sprays. And that was just too wimpy. So those have explosion cores. A few other things still have sprites. We probably should have just converted them all over to polygon models and taken some speed hit. It would have looked better, because occasionally you get an explosion in your face, and it's like someone has thrown a poster at you. And also, we have a ton of code. There's a whole separate assembly language pipeline for drawing perspective correct sprites. And it would have been really nice to have thrown that out. So in general, our thinking for real-time 3D is that sprites are pretty much obsolete, except maybe if you want cartoony type effects where they can certainly be effective. Can you flip? Okay, now we come to particles. Particles are solid colored, distance scaled rectangles used in clusters of hundreds for dynamic events like rocket trails or explosions. So this rocket trail is, let me see, is particles, okay? Now, and so is that explosion. And let's see if we can find someone here. So is that. And the thing is, when you look at this, not to say it's not awful, because it's awful, but and not to say that it also that it's not technically awful, because it's technically awful. It's a bunch of pixels. But how else do you produce an effect like that in software? It works. It's not a huge speed hit. People instantly know what it is. I think that hardware alpha blending is going to make these go away totally. If you look at GLQuake and you look at those particles, you say, wow, they really don't belong here. They look better because they've now been alpha blended to be round. Originally, they were triangles. You know, it'd be really weird. You'd blow someone up, and there'd be all these red triangles flying in your face. And you say, well, that's wrong. So this is another piece of technology. It had a window of usefulness. That window's probably over after the Quake engine. A couple of non-graphics topics I wanted to mention. I just want to reemphasize that ray casting for line of sight in a BSP is a thing of beauty. And one reason I reemphasize that is because in Doom, John had this horrible thing with figuring out visibility through polygons. It was slow. It was complex. It didn't always work. And when he had lunch for the first time with Bruce Naylor, a leading BSP researcher, he described this to Bruce. And Bruce said, you have a BSP. Why don't you just like use the BSP and clip a line into it? And John went, oh my god. I mean, it's like he couldn't imagine how he had missed it. But if John could miss it, you know, it's pretty easy to miss, I think, then. Also, people ask me a lot of times, how do you do collision detection with the world? And this is actually a very clever thing. Instead of taking the movement of the bounding box, which is a difficult volumetric problem, what is done is the world BSP tree is taken and it's puffed in. And the amount it's puffed in by is exactly the distance that you would have to move to get to the center of the player's bounding box if the player were right against you. So if this is a polygon and here's the player standing here, it moves in until it's at the center of the player along its normal. Now what this does is you can think of it at the same time you dwindle the player down to a point because the whole world has been expanded by the dimensions to a center. Now you can do the collision detection as a point test instead of as a volume test. And to do player motion, all you do is you take this expanded BSP tree and you clip the line for the player's motion into it and see if it hits something. It's efficient, it's easy, it's pretty much foolproof, except it was a little difficult getting the beveling of surfaces right when the expansion happened. It's a really good approach. The downside right now is that you need a BSP tree for every size of bounding box you want to work with. So in Quake, there are two sizes. There's the player, which almost every monster goes through, even if it's not quite the same size. And there's the Shambler, which has a really big box. John thinks it can be made scalable on demand, but he hasn't actually tried it. That would actually be a useful thing. Okay, flip. Now I'm going to talk even faster, because that's the Quake part. Now is what we did with our summer vacation. After we shipped Quake, the first thing we did was vQuake, the port to the Rendition Verite chip. First thing I'll say is if you haven't seen Quake or any game, but it's useful to compare Quake software and Quake hardware, running with and without bilinear filtering and higher res software versus hardware, and RGB, it looks great, and it's real clear that the next generation of games that are really designed for hardware are going to be a huge leap. And no one's ever going to have to deal with 8-bit and palettes again. I'm sure there are a lot of artists in the world who are really grateful. The most interesting thing about vQuake was that the Verite chip had really marginal fill rate for what Quake wanted to do. And it also has a RISC processor on there, fully programmable. So basically, in Quake, the board becomes a specialized span processor. The CPU still does the edge list, builds the spans, builds the surfaces, and feeds all these things to the Verite chip, and the chip just does the rasterization. And this worked out quite well, especially considering the limitations that we're working with. The surface cache becomes more painful. That's one thing we learned. Two reasons. One is the surfaces are 16 bits per pixel. They take longer to build. And they have to be downloaded to the board, in this case through DMA, and they're twice as big as they should have been, and they take up more texture space. So surface caching turns out to be more of a hit with hardware, with 16-bit hardware, and it may be that surface caching is another one of those things with a limited window of applicability, at least as the fundamental lighting tool. Another interesting thing is the edge list helps a lot, because otherwise we'd have to download even more surfaces, and it avoids the overdraw, which made it possible for Verite to draw fast enough. But it pushes things back on the CPU. So unlike, to much less extent than GLQuake, vQuake basically scales a lot with CPU speed. It's not like you plunk a board in and, wow, it just runs fast. You plunk a board into Pentium Pro 200, it really runs great, but it still lets the CPU do a lot. Okay, flip slide. Okay, GLQuake. GLQuake, unlike vQuake, really has significantly different drawing and much more demanding for a couple of reasons that we'll see shortly. The first thing I'll mention with GLQuake is that it sorts by texture. It doesn't go front to back. It doesn't go back to front. The BSP is not used for drawing order at all, although with hardware, it certainly is possible to use the BSP to advantage. If you have hardware that can Z-fill faster than it can Z-buffer, or you want to have hardware that can do Z-rejection faster and you can go front to back. One other thing I'll mention is that we don't clear the Z-buffer. What we do instead is we split the Z-buffering into two dynamic ranges, and we basically use 15 bits in each range and switch the polarity of the compare each time. And that means we only have 15 bits. And it turns out there are places in GLQuake where if you get far enough back, you can see Z-buffered things poking through doors because there's not enough resolution to do it correctly. So 15 bits is really getting marginal on the Z-buffering. So there's no edge list. There's just polygons. We throw all the polygons and the PVS at the hardware. And what's interesting about that is that you get overdraw, sometimes two or three times overdraw. So that's one reason it takes a faster board, because you need a lot of fill bandwidth to do that. The second thing is the way we do the lighting. Rather than surface caching, it's two-pass lighting. First, the texture, the raw texture, which is fully lit, gets drawn with the tiling into the frame buffer. Then the light map is used as an alpha texture, and it, too, is textured right over it. And the board does the filtering between the light map points, and it does the alpha blending to dim down the texture appropriately. This gives exactly the same effects, basically, as what you get out of surface caching, except for the fact that you can't do lookup table type tricks like getting full bright colors that aren't shaded. And in fact, dynamic lighting isn't done at all for speed reasons, because it would take a lot of time to download the light maps for the dynamic lighting. Instead, what happens is a ball of light is just alpha blended in. That's fast. It also doesn't really look great. And John has since figured out a way he can probably get it to look as good as the software version without a big hit. And what that is instead of putting the texture in first and then alpha blending to light it, you take your static light and you put it in the buffer first as RGB. And then you take your dynamic light, which is just one circular texture, and you appropriately texture map it on top of that, another lighting path doing add with saturate. And then you take your regular texture and you multiply it with the lighting. Now, this means that when you do dynamic lighting, you do an extra pass, but we already do an extra pass to get the ball of light in for dynamic lighting. And it's a good illustration that the hardware pipelines with the alpha blending and the different kinds of combinations really have some interesting potential that's going to take a little while to figure out how to use. So, to compare two-pass lighting to Garot has much less detail. It's the same arguments, all the same things I said about surface caching, except that Garot, of course, has doesn't require you to draw everything twice. Versus surface caching, you don't have the memory and the download and the leveling problems, but you don't have the potential for procedural texturing that you have with the surfaces, where you could say use MMX to do really interesting things into your textures and then download them. And what I think is quite possible is that a future direction will be to do most of your world with two-pass lighting and to do specific things for good effect with surface caching, so surface cache doesn't hog too much memory or hurt the frame rate too much. Another interesting thing is I keep saying, well, two-pass lighting is great, but it's double the bandwidth. And on the Nintendo 64, we found when we ported Quake that, in fact, the N64 can be set up to do both passes simultaneously at basically no cost. It'll texture from two textures, the light map and from the actual normal texture at the same time. So there's no cost to doing it. It's two-pass effect, but it only takes one pass. And I expect to see a lot more of that coming for PC hardware. And once that's there, it's pretty clear that, you know, doing two-pass lighting in one pass is a pretty ideal hardware approach. One other two-pass approach that Brian Hook told me about that I think is a really interesting one, at least for now, is to do two-pass lighting for the world, but to do your dynamic lighting by doing Garot shading. The boards are built to do Garot shading for free. So it's a nice way to not pick up any of the overhead and get dynamic lighting out of it. Flip, please. Okay, so now we come to a few eye candy items, which I could have subtitled Why John Carmack Loves 3D Hardware. John has become much more willing to try things with GL because instead of saying, well, I'm going to have to spend a weekend and write a hacked up rasterizer to see what it looks like, and then we'll have to optimize it to make it useful in a product, you can just sit down, spend a couple hours, and call someone in and say, notice anything different, which is what happened with dynamic shadows. He came in and he said, you see anything different? I'm looking, and it looks to me like maybe they've changed the walking soldier because he looks so well pegged to the ground, it looks more realistic. And it took me a couple of minutes. All of a sudden, I said, oh my God, he has a shadow. And it makes a big difference. It makes his feet look pegged to the floor. It makes it seem like a real world, even though, again, the shadow is always from the north. It's, you know, the same thing. And even better, if you walk to the edge of a cliff, your shadow walks right over it. It's just an alpha blend onto the ground plane. But that's a fixable problem. It's definitely fixable to project it just into the relevant part, especially with the PVS. Similarly, translucency was totally trivial. The only thing that had to be done was that the PVS had to be expanded so that you could see what was under the water, because that's not normally in your PVS. But being in the water and looking up and seeing out of it or looking down into it really makes things look a lot more realistic. I mean, that's just a dead obvious application. Also, reflections. And reflections were a little more complicated, but a little more rewarding. I mean, the first time I walked up to a mirror and kind of jumped in the air and watched myself jump, I was like, wow, this is great. And that one also, that was just, you know, a couple of hours to stick in. And what that consists of, you draw your scene except for the mirror, and you use half of your Z range. Then you draw the scene from behind the mirror using the other half of your Z range that makes everything look farther away so you don't splatter all over everything that was already there. And it just shows up in that hole. The only trick is you can't have anything behind the mirror in your PVS because everything in the scene is going to show up as closer because of the Z range splitting. But and the thing about doing it that way with hardware, it's like the reflections of mirrors are round, the mirrors are jagged, it doesn't even have to be rectangular things. And we had talked about putting all these things in Quake. But, you know, the idea of the amount of software it needed to go in and the maintenance on it and optimizing made it not possible. So I would really say that, you know, hardware in this way makes 3D programming a whole lot more fun. It makes it possible to just try things and to get really quick feedback, which is why I did graphics in the first place, because it's just fun to see it quickly. Flip. I don't have much to say about WinQuake because it was just a straight port of a DOS game, basically. And that actually is a pretty pretty important thing to say. It came out as a DOS quality game. Sometimes at the beginning you get some swapping, which is a little bit annoying, and it takes 16 megs, not 8 megs. But otherwise, you know, I ported a DOS game to Windows, and it runs like a DOS game, which is a big deal. The other big deal is that the future of gaming clearly involves the internet, at least for our kind of gaming. And you get TCP/IP support under Windows, and you don't get it under DOS. And that's just a huge thing. I mean, we had a hacked up system for getting it under Win95 for the DOS game. And it's so nice to just use the built-in WinSock stuff. It worked the first day we tried it. I'll also say that NT works great, except the sound is a little bit lagged. And it would be nice if it had low-res modes, but you can stretch it up. And it's really great to develop on. I mean, I thank God I got to develop it on NT. And every time I screwed up, I actually got the screen back, right? And on Win95, I'd be testing stuff, and I'd lock the screen, and I'd reboot. And NT is an excellent development platform. And the final thing is just the future of gaming is pretty clearly a networked Win32 world. And that's just, you know, that's where it is heading. There's not going to be a DOS version of any more games. I just think that's where things are going. Next. Okay, I want to talk about Quake World. But before I can talk about Quake World, I have to talk about Quake networking so you can see what changed. Quake is client server from the ground up. And that was by design for two reasons. One, it's simple and robust. Another, it lets you have persistent worlds where people can easily come and go on the internet. And that worked well. It was an architecture where the server maintains the time base, maintains everything. The clients are just dumb. You send your input off, the server processes it 10 or 20 times a second, it sends it back. One side effect of that is that if you're holding a key down and you're moving forward and then you let up because you see lava coming, and the server says, okay, I saw your key down, you're moving, and then the server doesn't see your packet because it gets delayed, the server goes by the latest input. So when you finally get control back, you're in the lava. And that turns out to be really frustrating for people who don't have great internet connections. The only client-server exception in Quake is orientation. As you move the mouse or the keyboard to look, that happens instantly because it can't cause any problems, any inconsistency with the server. So one problem with client-server, though, is that it's high latency, especially when you're talking about modems on the internet, because you have to make a round trip for everything. And Qtest 1, the first test we put out, as of that time, it was even higher latency because what John did to get rid of roughness was he lagged Quake a little further. He actually introduced latency so it could interpolate between the last two server points instead of pegging you to the last one, which gives a jerky effect. And it made things smoother, but it also made things even less responsive. And it illustrates that latency and smoothness are often direct trade-offs. And in fact, you could always introduce enough latency to be smooth. I mean, even on the worst internet connection, if you add in 10 seconds of latency, it'll be smooth. It won't be playable, but it'll be smooth. The other thing is that as of Qtest 1, it was TCP. It was reliable delivery. And that meant if a packet had any problems, you know, it had to be retransmitted by the network layer, and things would just stop dead. So after Qtest 1, John decided reliable delivery was a fundamentally wrong assumption. And he switched from TCP to UDP so that it was unreliable delivery. He only used reliable delivery for things like scores. And every frame, he would send the entire state of the relevant state of the world, which the PVS helped with. But obviously, it's highly compressed, and it limits what you can do. But that way, if a packet gets dropped, it doesn't matter. The game logic deals with the fact that packets get dropped. And John said that was the fundamentally wrong assumption, was letting the network layer deal with it instead of the game. But he didn't rewrite the code from scratch. He fiddled with it. And what he ended up with was 8,000 lines of hard-to-debug code. And there were some really nasty bugs that only got fixed in the week before. Actually, Quake 1 shipped. There were some bugs in the previous earlier released beta versions. Can you flip the slide? So for Quake World, John said, the heck with this, and he completely rewrote it from scratch. It ended up as 1,500 lines. And it's just, you know, if you change your assumptions, it's a good thing to change your code. It seems simpler to just hack it so it keeps working, but then you're carrying around all this baggage. So as of the time we shipped Quake, it was quite smooth, unless there was huge latency. But there were large latency problems, especially over modems where it was 200 milliseconds plus basically all the time. So John did Quake World really just as an experiment in attacking latency and also in multiplayer stuff, but particularly to see what he could do about the latency. It's purely multiplayer. And it attacks latency two ways. One is that the time base is owned by the client. Your time base is yours. So what you do is on the client, you monitor how long the key is down and up, and you say, OK, I ran this far this frame. And you send a packet, and you move immediately. You send the packet off to the server, and you say, server, I moved this far. And as soon as the server gets that information, it simulates the world right up to where you are. okay, at that point, using the information you gave it. It brings all the other platforms and doors and missiles up to that point. It doesn't do anything with the other clients because they control their time bases, and it sends you a response right away. So instead of getting 50 or 100 milliseconds of additional latency while the server decided it was time to process a frame, you get an immediate response. So that was 50 to 100 milliseconds saved. This takes more horsepower because every client is causing the server to simulate instead of there just being these fixed time slices, but still runs fine on a Pentium. And the server still owns control of events. If there's an explosion, that's on the server. All you maintain control of is when you move. Now, flip again, please. What owning control of when you move means is that you can predict yourself too, and it will not be jerky or warping you to different places, because you're telling the server, I just did this move, and the server does what you tell it to. So except in those cases where you like get blown up by a rocket and don't know it and go flying off, your movement is instant. It's totally responsive. And John has just also started predicting the other clients with dead reckoning, which does cause them to warp sometimes, but makes the experience better. Other objects in the world currently, like platforms go choom, 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 because it's only when you get a server packet back that you know that they moved. One thing this causes is a mild paradox, because you are seeing your motion and the dead reckoning for the other player's motions may be overruled by the server. You're not going to see something like you blow someone up and it gets undone, but you can see that you shoot somewhere and all of a sudden the person's not there. So you could say the trade-off's really latency versus smoothness versus consistency. That's another factor. Quake World is more complex code. It's less general. John said he was really glad he didn't try to do it in Quake because it was much more complex to implement. You get these mild paradoxes and inconsistencies. You get this jerkiness for other objects. But modem play is way better. People like it better, even with all those things. And it was kind of an interesting lesson, because we mostly played on a network. And on a network, you want to be pure client-server. But until the latency and the bandwidth for the connections most people have improve, I think that client-side prediction and less stupid clients is pretty much necessary. So this stuff's going to go into Quake 2. John anticipates predicting more in the future. And when I get to path-based motion, you'll see one really useful aspect of how to predict in the future for things like plats. One other thing John's thinking of doing is, instead of sending the full state every time, sending just the state that's changed since the last acknowledgement back from the client. So that would help a little with the data load. One final thing I don't think anybody anticipated is bots. For those of you who don't know, bots are software that play Quake. Instead of running the Quake executable, the bot runs. And some of them are fully automatic. They just run around and shoot. And some of them are assists for people, so the people can steer, but this helps them aim. And the thing about bots is, Quake sends out packets. Quake gets back packets. We don't know if there's a person out there. Right now, you can detect a bot because, for example, a bot knows everything in the PVS, even if it can't actually see it. So sometimes, you'll be hiding around a corner, and all of a sudden, there'll be this rain of rockets coming down right next to you. And you'll say, how did they know I was there? It's because it was a bot. It was cheating. It couldn't see you, but it knew you were there, which is incredibly annoying. Almost as annoying as chasing someone, shooting at them, and suddenly they shoot you out of their back, which bots also do. Now, those are pretty obvious. And one thing I've noticed, socially, this is so weird, because why would you want to use a bot like that, right? I mean, what's the fun? You're not doing anything. And if you ask people, are you using a bot, they'll refuse to answer. Or they'll say, no, I'm not using a bot. And you'll say, you shot me out of your back. You're using a bot. And finally, they'll admit, OK, I was. And I have no idea why. But in the longer run, this is a really important implication for internet gaming. It's like steroids. You can't tell, right? I think that in the future, internet gaming is going to consist of an unfortunate situation where it's a combination of playing skill and who has the assists that are most effective flying under the radar. Because it's just clear to me that, OK, instead of shooting out of the back, right, it's only going to give you a 10-degree advantage in aiming. 10 degrees is a big deal. So I think you will all of you who are working with the internet will run into this. I mean, Diablo ran into a similar type of problem just with people cheating. But it's depressing. People are faceless on the internet, and it's really easy to cheat. OK, flip. Quake 2. I can't talk at all about Quake 2 as a game. I'm going to talk about some interesting technical stuff, though, although a lot of it is not 3D. The engine is not the focus of Quake 2. It's Win32 only, not DOS, no more DOS games. John put in radiosity, real radiosity, bouncing the light around the world. And sometimes it's great. Lava glows beautifully. There are some fluorescent lights that look great. Sometimes, you know, it doesn't actually look as good as the artist just sticking lights in. The other thing is it's slow. Without the PVS, it would be just incredibly slow, but it's still slow. It's another big addition to the pre-processing time. The sky is not going to be there. It's going to be an infinite distance environment cube. And what that means is that, by God, you can finally look out over things like you could in Doom. And it's great. It really is nice. It gets rid of that claustrophobic feeling that Quake had. There are going to be multicolored lights and hardware. And this is interesting. John's theory is that if there are effects you can do in hardware and you can decimate in software over the next couple of years, it's worth doing. So it's going to be multicolored in hardware, but it's going to be white light in software. There's going to be translucency, both hardware and software. The world's going to be more alive, more moving stuff. It turns out we thought, well, you know, B models, you do all this clipping, you put it in the edge list, probably shouldn't be too many. It turns out you can actually put a lot of B models in and it works. So there's all kind of moving stuff like conveyor belts and gears and things. And it makes a big difference. You don't feel like you're walking around a museum, you know, where a couple of things are moving. It's like everything in the world seems to be real. Also, more polygons. The world is going to have more polygons per scene and bigger levels. And there's going to be a lot more in the models. The models are going to go from 300 to 500 to maybe 500 to 800 polygons. And it turns out that all those polygons are additional detail, pretty much, because if all you have is 300, basically your arms are boxes. It's all you can do to get a model. And all the extra ones go into detail. It makes things look great. Faces aren't, you know, cubes anymore. They're actually sort of curved. And that advance in number of polygons is really just because machines are getting faster. There's no technology there. There are things like physical knockback. The more you seem to interact with the world, the better, and that has worked out nicely. QuakeC is going away, replaced by DLLs. DLLs are faster. DLLs are debuggable with a debugger, which turns out to be a good thing. And QuakeC was great. It let a lot of people who had no programming skill and no programming compilers do interesting things. But DLLs are going to take care of the fact that there's a lot more stuff that has to happen, a lot more server processing. And it's better not to interpret that. There will be internet browser support. Basically, right now for Quake World, you can use an internet browser plugin to go out and jump into games. That seems like a pretty obvious direction. One neat thing is demo packet playback. Basically, the client just plays whatever the server sends it. So say you want to do an explosion. It's a complicated explosion with all these arcs that you don't want to be calculating on the fly. Well, pre-calculate it, and then at the time the event happens, just send the packets describing the motions. Of course, they won't collide with you. They can't do damage. They can't interact with the world. But they can provide a really spectacular effect. And it's a good example of taking advantage of the client-server architecture to make things lightweight. Finally, path-based motion. Right now in Quake, if you want to make a model walk from one place to another place, you calculate it every step with scripting language. There are round-off errors that cause it to get inaccurate. It's slow in terms of processing. It takes up net bandwidth. So instead, what we do is we predefine the paths, and then we just use a parametric t value along the predefined path. So you send one number that says where you are. There's no chance of inaccuracy. And one really nice thing, you can't predict the motion on a door over the internet. You know why? Because the door will go right through the wall. It doesn't know where to stop. We don't have any information. They're just objects. So if it's path-based, it hits the end, it stops. OK. I have 5 minutes to finish this. Flip. Looking ahead, it's pretty clear to me that the technology for the next generation of breakthrough games in Quake's class is going to emerge from the combination of 3D hardware and the internet. And the next engine is Trinity, aimed at Christmas of 98. Minimum baseline machine is a Pentium Pro 200 with MMX, 32 megs of RAM, 50 megapixels a second, and 300K Z-buffer triangles a second, and real alpha has to be supported. This is probably pushing it. It's probably rejecting half of the target audience, but you know what? Quake did that too by not supporting the 486 properly. And it will enable some really, really different things to be done. Can you flip again? Okay, so the goal is to do less constrained, better connected worlds that are more extensible. Just, okay, Quake got there. There are things on the internet that are persistent. Now let's push that farther. And one of the big, to give you an idea of what that means, imagine you're standing there and you're looking out across a scene. But part of what you're seeing in the scene isn't even running on your server. That part over there is a different server. You can walk to the different server. Big open visibility across multiple servers. A huge challenge in that is level of detail, because you need more geometry to get these big open spaces. You need more detail up close to make it seem more real. But those work against each other, because if you have more detail everywhere times the bigger scenes, you're going to have huge numbers of polygons. So you need level of detail to resolve it so that you only deal with the number of polygons necessary at the distance that you're at. And so right now, the Trinity engine is tessellating dynamically from curved surfaces. So there are oval pillars, and they always look oval no matter how far away you get. But when you're really far away, it's 4 polygons. And if you crank down the level of detail just a little, all of a sudden they look faceted. He also has level of detail fractal landscapes. And one key with this is it's not popping in new polygons. It's smoothly morphing. It adds a vertex on top of another one, and then it morphs it to its final position. So you never see the popping. Similarly with polygon models, the idea is that the vertices will morph to drop out triangles, or morph down edges, and you'll lose triangles. So you can build an 800 polygon or 1,000 polygon model that at a distance is only 100 or 200 polygons. And this makes for easy frame rate adjustment too, just crank down the level of detail a little. Interestingly, you can't use display lists or execute buffers with this architecture, because every scene at every distance is totally different. So I think that illustrates how the focus has moved up to different kinds of challenges, but there are plenty of challenges remaining with hardware rasterization. So in closing, I'd like to thank Ed for letting me give this talk again. I'd like to say sharing information is cool if you can do it, and I'll take questions in a minute. Detail to resolve it so that you only deal with the number of polygons necessary at the distance that you're at. And so right now, the Trinity engine is tessellating dynamically from curved surfaces, so there are oval pillars, and they always look oval no matter how far away you get, but when you're really far away, it's four polygons. And if you crank down the level of detail just a little, all of a sudden they look faceted. He also has level of detail fractal landscapes. And one key with this is it's not popping in new polygons. It's smoothly morphing. It adds a vertex on top of another one, and then it morphs it to its final position, so you never see the popping. Similarly with polygon models, the idea is that the vertices will morph to drop out triangles. They'll morph down edges and you'll lose triangles. So you can build an 800 polygon or 1,000 polygon model that at a distance is only 100 or 200 polygons. And this makes for easy frame rate adjustment too, just crank down the level of detail a little. Interestingly, you can't use display lists or execute buffers with this architecture because every scene at every distance is totally different. So I think that illustrates how the focus has moved up to different kinds of challenges, but there are plenty of challenges remaining with hardware rasterization. So in closing, I'd like to thank Ed for letting me give this talk again. I'd like to say sharing information is cool if you can do it, and I'll take questions in a minute. Okay, any questions? Okay, right there.
Won't switching from Quake C to DLLs make Quake 2 more susceptible to crashing and so on by incompetent or malicious programmers?
That's actually an interesting question. John basically ran this debate on the internet. You put stuff on your system all the time that came from basically random programmers. I mean, you know, stuff gets downloaded into your browser. You get sent mail, and I agree, I was concerned about the possibility of that, but it doesn't seem to be a major factor. That's just a matter of opinion. We'll see. Maybe a year from now you'll be saying, wow, I was right, but nobody knows yet. Yep.
Yeah, it seems like in the last year you've changed your opinion about the Pentium Pro, and can you talk about what you think about MMX?
Change my opinion about Pentium Pro, how?
Well, it seemed before, at your last talk, you said that you really understood the Pentium and how great it was to optimize for and simulate.
Right, and the Pentium Pro is very hard to optimize for. For floating point, it does the optimization for you to a large extent. I was startled at how much. For integer, actually, it turns out just good assembly language makes a big difference still. But the Pentium Pro is a great chip. I actually like it. It's not a great optimizing chip, which is disappointing. The Pentium was the best optimizing chip I've ever seen in my life. You know, two pipes, well-defined rules. It was just the right level.
And MMX?
MMX. Well, we don't have a use for it yet, but I was pointing out that the surface building was a potential use for MMX. And, I mean, hey, MMX is really powerful. I'd love to figure out a way to use it. So that's one potential way to do it. Anybody else? Yes.
What do you think is the future of visible surface determination? Do you think the PVS is the way to go?
Okay. You know, once you have fast hardware and you're relying on Z-buffering, it becomes a much coarser type of thing. I can see that, you know, you could say I'm in a big area, a lot of open stuff, and you just say this collection of 1,000 polygons, you know, is one set of it. So instead of saying, well, I'm going to have to carve it up with a BSP and define granularity, you might just say I have a collection of polygons, and you need to have some higher coarse thing, like the way flight sims use gridding. I definitely would not say that I believe that BSP is the ultimate data structure for this stuff. Once you move outdoors, BSPs don't work very well, for example. That's one of those open-ended questions. Anybody else? Yes.
How did you integrate the Z-buffer characters into the BSP?
Okay, they're not integrated at all. What we do is we use the BSP world to draw everything, and then we fill the Z-buffer appropriately. And then you can think of it as just painting on top of a static scene. We use z-buffering to draw them on top of it. So it's the same thing as if somebody had pulled something off the disk with a z-buffer and then drawn into it, except that we construct it on the fly. I can't hear you, I'm sorry. Of course. Every wall fills the z-buffer with the right value. It's just not drawn using z-buffering. And so the moving things do z-buffer exactly correctly. It's not an approximation. Yes? Because it's a big open-ended problem that I think is going to make a whole lot of difference in the next 3 to 5 years. And for once, instead of coming in late after other people have done the really cool groundbreaking stuff, I want to be the person who did that when it breaks into the open. And it's a really interesting optimization problem. Really interesting.
So you're using assembly
rule. Well, they are to some extent, but you know, this is really not a this isn't a case where you need to get, you know, 20% or 40% faster. This is a case where you need to figure out a different way to do it so it really works better, and then you need to make it orders of magnitude faster. So it's a big problem. Yes.
As your worlds grow larger, that your recursive algorithms can cause problems with like blowing the cache and things like that?
Well, which recursive algorithms in particular?
Such as the way that you walk your world.
Yeah, and there's no question. I mean, even now we're blowing the cache, right? I mean, Quake is not a very cache-friendly program in general. An example of that is surfaces. You know, a surface is up to 64K. It's not really a great idea to, you know, to texture map out of a 64K thing. And the BSP tree isn't organized for that either. We did do some things like repacking a lot of the span structure and stuff to fit in cache lines, and it made, you know, noticeable many percent differences in some cases. And we did cache line prefetching, and that helped too. I think those are going to be big problems. And I don't know if you've noticed, but main memory is not getting fast at the speed that processors are getting faster. So I do think that all of you will find a year or two from now that you can start getting big speed ups by reorganizing your data. For example, break it into two arrays, the most frequently used part, the least frequently used part, that kind of stuff. So it's a great question. It's a tough problem, and it's something that most programmers just don't think about. You know, they don't really have the scope to think about it at the time. Yes?
Will you continue to work on graphics technology?
I am not planning to work on graphics technology for at least for a while. Yes?
It was interesting to hear you talk about some of the things that you were changing quite a bit. It seemed like wait until after the time you were shipping. Can you talk a little bit about the methodology and things that you use and what you learned about what works and doesn't work in the market when you want to change so much?
Well, there's no methodology. That's the first thing I would say. It would be basically, more John than me, but it would be basically saying, you know, this is a good thing, let's try to put it in. And there are a ton of things that aren't in there. You know, the Quake engine has been licensed a bunch of times, and the licensees are doing really interesting things with it. And Quake 2 has a lot of interesting things that aren't in Quake, and almost every one of them is something that somebody wanted to put in that we knew was technically feasible. And that's part of what I was saying about ship it. I mean, would it have been better if Quake had been a year later and it had been Quake 2 when Quake 2 is coming out a year later? So that one, I would say that the secret is have a dictator. And John Carmack basically is that dictator, for better or worse. What you do is you let someone make the decisions and get the product shipped. And inevitably, things will get left out. Inevitably, there will be disappointments. In terms of putting in new technology, I don't know. I mean, I think as the industry has gotten bigger and the visibility of it has gotten bigger, it's gotten harder and harder to do this walk the hairy edge type thing. Because in the paper, I talked about passages, which is something that John almost put in way, way too late, I thought. I mean, it would have been definitely risky in terms of bugs. But he just felt like it was the right thing. And you know, when John feels like something's the right thing, capital letters, it tends to go in the product. And that's really all there is to it. But I mean, I was doing assembly language for the Polygon models up until a week before we shipped. And then John made me stop. So really, I mean, most of you don't have this ability, and that's unfortunate. When you're only two programmers working on the code, and both of them like trust themselves with the code and are careful, it is amazing how much more you can get done than if you have to, you know, hit the point where you've got a bug database and you're pulling things out of the database and saying, oh, that doesn't matter anymore. You know, you just do what needs to be done. And of course, there's always the risk that you break something big time late, right? But again, you know, you ship shareware as your first product and you just ship a new update and everybody updates. So it's kind of a unique model, but it does seem to work pretty well. Any other questions? Yes.
You said that in the next version of Quake, you're going to let the clients set the times.
Well, in Quake, well, and, yeah, probably in Quake 2, right.
What happens in a situation where somebody fires a shot and at the present on the server, it looks like the target is going to be missed or is going to be hit, and then that target later sends a message saying, well, at that time in the past, I wasn't standing there, I was standing somewhere else. Is the server doing prediction?
The server, okay, that's a good question. The server can't make decisions until it knows where the clients are. And it doesn't make those decisions until it has that information. Now, that can mean that you've gone on past something and suddenly you've been blown up, right? Or you've been knocked backwards. I mean, that's just the way it goes. The server owns the events. And, you know, really, if you think about it, there's a paradoxical situation and you can't get around it. Either you wait for the signal to arrive or you make some good guesses. And with this one, at least, except in those very exceptional situations, what you personally do to your own character happens. And it happens immediately. And that turns out to be the biggest piece of feedback at the moment. The thing that makes people happiest. But you know, what you really want is you want under 100 milliseconds latency, and then you do client server, and then life is just good. Any other questions? Yes? Oh, I'll get you next. Go ahead.
Do you miss working in the game industry? Do you see a good time in the future when you might get back in?
Oh, well, considering that I've been changing jobs every 2.5 years for the past 15 years, I certainly wouldn't say that I'll never do it. But it's an interesting thing. I'm a technological person. I'm not a game person. And it doesn't mean that it wasn't a lot of fun working at id, but there are a lot of people I know who really burn to do games. And they, you know, they'll play games, they'll take Mario 64 home and they'll get all the stars. And I mean, what they love to do is play games and write games and do games. And what I really wanted to do is I wanted to do Network Worlds, because I thought it was a really interesting direction the world was going. And I still do, and soon those will converge. But unfortunately, because of the lack of anything better than modems, it's going to take longer than I thought for those to converge. So it's really interesting, but it's not, you know, it's not burning in my blood. So yeah, I could come back, but I'm a technical person. Where John is a technical game person, there's a big difference. Yes?
Do you foresee span processing showing up in hardware?
No. Hardware, you know, one nice thing is that this has all been mapped out. You know how, to a large extent over the last 15 years, Intel has prospered mightily by doing things that have been done on mini computers and mainframes with commodity technology. That's not to downplay the magnitude of the engineering achievement, but you know, caches aren't new. Pretty much all these techniques have been pioneered other places until pretty recently. Similarly, with 3D pipelines, you know, there's a pretty good model to work off of. There are some really high-powered 3D pipelines out there. And right now, just getting the polygons thrown down the pipelines faster takes us so far. I mean, my personal prediction is at least a doubling in terms of fill rate and polygon rate every year for at least the next 5 years, just with this pipeline, regardless of any cool new technology comes. And then you're 30 times faster. I mean, 30 times. When's the last time you even saw an order of magnitude? Much faster than processor technology. So, no, I think those specialized approaches are cool, and maybe in a console it's worth doing, but for the broad, you know, PC platform, we get so far with just the classic technology. Yes?
Now that you work at Microsoft, do you have some more time to write articles for Dr. Dobbs again?
Well, actually, it turns out I have less time. And actually, I always write articles about what I'm doing. And I can't write articles about what I'm doing because A, there's no one who would want to read it, and B, I can't talk about it yet. So unfortunately, the answer to that would be no, although it is too bad because, you know, I do feel like a lot of good things have happened just from spreading information around. And I was really fortunate to work at id where, you know, the philosophy, John's philosophy really is that tell people how you're doing stuff, everything gets better. I mean, it sounds funny, it sounds corny, but he actually does that. And occasionally his partners have to sit on him to keep him from doing that even more. You know, the Wolf 3D code got released, right? John had his preference the Quake code would be released. But commercially, that seems like a bad idea. Yes?
You mentioned the size of the data sets for animation of characters. Uh-huh. And with the polygon count doubling, was internal skeleton used?
It's not, and it was thought about, but you know, Quake 2 was supposed to be basically a level pack, right? That's what Doom 2 was. And because Quake was not as properly done as Doom in the sense that it was finished and just dead on right, and because there are a lot of interesting things to do, it has worked out differently. But making a change to, say, skeletons is a fairly large change, and you have to pick the spots carefully, especially if John's going to get Trinity done, you know, for Christmas of 98. So the answer is no, but it is a really good idea that could have a major impact on the data set working size. Yes?
You mentioned that Quake C will be turning into DLLs.
Yeah.
Is that a security problem? Could anyone compile any code into a DLL? Would that be an avenue for
Yes, you could, but you could. And the answer is you have to install the DLL on your system for it to cause any problem. And just like any software you install on your system, you shouldn't take arbitrary things from arbitrary people. I said the same thing you said, but that is the argument.
And the server download the DLL automatically?
No. Now, it could. I mean, and then you really have a problem, right? But no, it doesn't download them automatically. The servers don't download anything currently. In Quake World, it will download stuff, but I don't think that'll ever be in a commercial product. And you know, like I said to this other guy, check back in a year. Maybe it'll be the disaster of the year. You know, maybe there'll be headlines all over the place, Quake virus. I don't know. Anything else? Yes?
Can you comment on the size of the development team? You said there's just a
few. Well, at the time I left, there were me, John, and John Cash. John Cash is, you know, doing Quake C-type, well, scripting stuff and some network and modem stuff. So for the engine itself and the gameplay, that was me and John, plus Cash came in late for Quake. There are four level designers, one of whom is sitting right here, Sandy Peterson. There are three artists, and that's the team. Yeah, it is kind of amazing. And, you know, always more good artists is a plus. You can just, more artists makes things better. I mean, you look at, you know, Dark Forces, and you say, wow, more artists really help. But it's not clear that tons of, say, level designers would help. And in particular, there aren't tons of great level designers in the world. And it is clear that more programmers really wouldn't. With programming, you very quickly run into the communications problem, and it's very hard to find really great programmers to work on it anyhow. So the truth is that John is so infinitely productive, it's scary. And he just, mostly, he needed someone. He didn't, it was helpful that I wrote the assembly code. I certainly was an asset, but what you need more than anyone else is just someone to talk to. Because, you know, you sit up there, you think of ideas by yourself, it gets boring. So, and I don't think the development team will get substantially larger either. I mean, it seems to be a good working size. And actually, things on Quake 2 are going really, really well. So one of the questions I get all the time is, oh, is it imploding? And the answer is, actually, no. It is just going along so smoothly. Wait till you see Quake 2. You won't ask. Yes?
This is a follow-up to what you said there. So is there a replacement for you?
There's no one.
There is no replacement.
I think I could be replaced, but you know, all those people are doing interesting things too. So they're still looking. Anything else? Wow, this was shorter than last. Oh, one more, yes.
You mentioned modems are the limiting factor of creating virtual worlds. What do you think is the solution?
I don't know. I've never really thought about it. I'm not a network guy. Stuff like, basically, I mean, right now, one big solution is compression, right? For example, compressing from the last acknowledgement, that'll help a substantial amount in putting more people out there. But if you're talking about, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people and something as responsive as Quake, I think that's hard. If you have different servers owning different parts of it, and then you say, okay, if you want to see into the next server, you can do it, but there's going to be some lag, it's not going to be as accurate, then maybe you can do it that way. But you have to be pretty careful about what the servers, you know, what between the servers happens. Like if you shoot a rocket into that server, how does it get handed off? So the order of the problems get pretty large. And if you're saying one server, you know, how many people, that's really the limiting factor right now. I just don't see getting to 100, for example, in a Quake-type game. But I could be wrong. I don't know. The other piece of it is that from id's perspective, right, the object is really, it would be nice. We've all talked about this, having a big, rich world with lots of servers where everything, the phase of the moon affects different levels and stuff. But you know, that's not a commercial product in any way, shape, or form. And if you look at what's a commercial product, it's a much smaller scale. So it's going to be a very evolutionary process, I think, to get there. Yes?
What do you see as your best contributions to both Quake and to the graphics and gaming industry as a whole?
Well, the graphics industry was just writing a bunch of articles that some people found useful. And if not even if not that useful, you know, just made them think, hey, I can do this. And I have heard from lots of people, you know, who've gotten into doing graphics and gaming and just have had a good time. And I think that's great. On Quake, my biggest contribution was giving John someone to bounce ideas off of. And occasionally actually coming up with, like, for example, the idea of viewing the PVS calculations as being a linearly constrained problem instead of a sampling problem. He had not thought of. And the other contributions, there are 10,000 lines of assembly code in Quake. And I wrote all of them. And actually, there are no bugs in it, which I still can't believe. I don't understand how that could be, but there have not been any bugs. Maybe it's because every time you run a frame, all that code gets executed. I don't know. So the bugs just got wrung out really fast. But I certainly will say, you know, working at it was a great experience. John was a really good guy to learn from. And I'm certainly happy I did it. Yes?
Writing assembly code is becoming kind of a lost art.
Yeah, it certainly is. One thing I noticed is that almost no one who's come into the industry in the last 5 years writes assembly code. And it's not that it's not useful, but I mean, when you're thinking about things like Ole and you know, internet programming, it's like assembly language, you know, I have bigger problems. And people are willing to take, you know, a 50. If you turn off the assembly language in Quake and just run the pure C, it runs at about half the speed. But, you know, in a lot of cases, you can say half as fast, that's fine. For most apps, it's clearly fine, right? I mean, most apps, all I'll say is that the word processor I use now isn't any faster than WordStar was on my 286. I mean, and that's not even a criticism because it does different things, but the actual speed is no different. And so the speed just isn't important enough, I mean, with all the other things that have to be addressed. But it is nice to have the ability to step in a situation and say, huh, we need to be, you know, 30 or 40% faster. I can do that in a day, you know, and it will happen. And most people, the other thing is that most people, oh, this has always been true, who have known how to write assembly language don't really know how to write fast assembly language. And then you come to the last problem, which is that if you keep using the same assembly language over the lifetime of a product or into other products, it starts to become stale assembly language, like 386 assembly language, right? And it runs slower than C code on your current processor because the optimizations are wrong. I mean, I won't name any places where I've seen this, but a couple of places I've worked, I've looked at code and I've said, wow, this was really good 8088 code. Too bad that we're not running on 8088s. You know, it's optimized for fewest bytes, but so there is that problem, that assembly optimizations get stale. And I think that as of the Pentium Pro, it's reached the point where it never hurts to like make your code have fewer operations and be tighter, and you can still do that, but you don't get the same kind of. In Quake, every single assembly routine I touched got at least 45% faster, and I don't think that'll happen anymore. And in a Pentium Pro, it's very hard to know, to get a stable point to say, I'm optimizing off this point. You can only do it in huge loops, and even then, it's just a pain. And you know, it's like, I think we're close to the end of the road on this, although I've said it before. Yes?
Do you find that working for such a high-profile company and such a high-profile product, the fishbowl effect, did that ever impact development in a negative way?
Well, at the risk of incurring the wrath of the entire Quake community, I will say that probably wasn't a help. I mean, there are tons of suggestions, but there's so many suggestions that, you know, it's hard to winnow through them. And I would get lots of technical suggestions, many of which were good, but almost every one of them had already been thought of or was unfeasible for some reason. And I actually spent a lot of time answering mail about why we weren't doing things. People sometimes get annoyed and say, no, you don't see what I mean. And I did see what they mean. We'd even tried it in a lot of cases. I think the thing is, people like Doom, they like Quake, they like id, they want to help. And they want to be part of it. And you know, so part of it is they want you to say, wow, you're cool, but they also just want to help. I mean, that's a genuinely nice motive. But they really don't. I mean, that's what I would say. It's just not possible. It's a very small, contained development process. I mean, I think having it be so visible did have some impact because there's so much pressure to top Doom. And I know that John felt that pressure tremendously. one time I said to him, I'd gotten mail, and someone said, wow, it must be really stressful trying to top Doom. And I said, I don't think it was stressful because I didn't do Doom, right? And John said, I feel that every day. I mean, he definitely felt the pressure of trying to do it. So there's that. And also, you know, there are a lot of distractions that come with being like superstars. And that can definitely be an issue. You know, people start basically enjoying being successful and famous instead of not enjoying being successful and famous. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I think almost every company or every successful person goes through that phase where they're dealing with their own success. So unlike Doom, where it's just this incredible ride up, you know, Quake was a matter of staying up there, which is always harder. And I think they did a pretty incredible job under the circumstances. I mean, a lot of projects in those circumstances would just never ship. You know, you'd be saying, well, whatever happened to Quake, and kind of laughing. And I do think that, you know, having the dictator just put it out there when it's good enough to put out there is real useful. I will say that living in a fishbowl is a weird thing. And personally, it didn't do anything for me to be famous. You know, it's not like I said, wow, you know, all these people think I'm God. It's actually kind of embarrassing. Because the truth is, there are a ton of good programmers in the world. And I mean, I'm a good programmer. John's a great programmer. But there are a lot of them. And some of them just happen to be doing things that are more visible or that have a greater impact on the world at that time. And, you know, it doesn't make them different people. It just means they got, you know, they worked hard and they got lucky to some extent. Yes?
Why was it GL Quake instead of Direct3D Quake?
I can't really keep that going. You should ask them. I can't answer those questions. Ask John and he'll probably post it. Did you read his post? Go read through his plan file. Finger John C at itsoftware.com, and Ad actually describes all his thoughts on this. Which is interesting. I mean, how many of us have the ability to get several million people to read our innermost thoughts by posting them in our Finger file? He posted that, and within a day, I had heard from like hundreds of people asking me about it. Anything else? Okay, thank you. Oh, wait. There was one back there.
What do you think is the end of the road on number of polygons per frame?
There is no end of the road. We're 4 to 5 orders of magnitude from photorealistic. That's my theory. And we're not getting there anytime soon. So I think that you can be doing this in the year 2010, and you'll still be asking me that question, except maybe it won't be polygons. I don't know. So check back in 5 years. It'll be a lot better. Okay, thanks.